Well, thank you. I have my notes. I have my handy-dandy books. I'm Leslie. I'm an alcoholic again, and by that I qualify. And to qualify for this meeting, I had my last drink February 23rd, 1981, which means that was 38 years and change ago. And I just keep saying that because the baseline for this meeting is 30 years continuous sobriety or more. So I wanted to make sure that that's very clear on each of the discs. I mean, people who are here know, and people who attend meetings with me have an idea, but if you're listening out there, then you don't know. And the third step, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. The key phrases in that is making a decision, turning over, and to the care of God. Now that I have a 12 and 12, because I couldn't find my 12 and 12, whatever happened to it, I don't know. So I bought one here last week, large print, hooray, I didn't even know they made those. And it's really a huge help. But in the 12 and 12, and again, I was raised in recovery on AA literature primarily. I did not attend a rehab. So all I have to offer people is what I know and what I was taught and how I came to my recovery and my sobriety. So, but getting to that willingness, that's a whole thing. You know, the 12 and 12 talks about there is only one key, and it's called willingness. Once unlocked by willingness, the door almost opens of itself. We saw that we were powerless over alcohol, but we also perceived that faith of some kind, if only in AA itself, is possible to anyone. These conclusions did not require action. They required only acceptance. So that's the first step and the second step, that we kind of let that soak in. I had to let that soak in and to just drop the debate. The 12 and 12 goes on to talk about faith alone can avail nothing. We can have faith and yet keep God out of our lives. And that's true. I told you last week, and I'll repeat again, you know, I believed in God, but I hated God. That's where I was. So I guess you can call that having faith, but, you know, keeping a God out of my life. So that kind of, if you have an attitude like I had, then yes, that fits. So the problem becomes how and by what means do we let Him in? And it talks about making a decision to turn our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Now, the 12 and 12 goes on to talk about how, you know, we can open the door and let it shut. And there's a bit of a process. As I understand it, you know, the third step is a bit of a commitment. It's a commitment, an agreement to go forward and work the program to our level best. It's given a promise to myself and to the program that I'm going to work it, or that's how I see it. That's what that decision is part of. A decision doesn't mean anything unless it's followed by action. I mean, I told people plenty of times, I've decided I'm going to blah, 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 and never followed through with Jack. So, sometimes the 12 and 12 at page 36 talks about if some of fighting this is logic, trying to bolster egotism, you know, that self-centered I. And that's not good. But the more we become willing to depend upon a higher power, the more independent we actually are. Therefore, dependence, as AA practices it, means gaining a true independence of spirit. And I found that to be true. I found that to be true. And also, again, I want to go back to the brains, because I was one, I was smart. I'm still smart, but I was smart then. Yeah, I know. I know. But that was part of my hurdle. And what the step three in the 12 and 12 talks about, this was something that I suffered from, so I share this with you. We are certain that our intelligence, backed by willpower, can rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world we live in. This brave philosophy, wherein each man plays God, sounds good in the speaking, but it still has to meet the acid test. How well does it actually work? One good look in the mirror ought to be enough answer for any alcoholic. And it was for me. I had a problem looking at myself in the mirror when it came to this point. You know, I struggled because I knew this and I was going through, it's just hard. I don't know how else to say it, but it's not easy to come to that mental commitment. I guess commitment is the best word. The book goes on to talk about the results normal people get from self-sufficiency, and we're not even normal, you know. So the normal people end up filled with fear and anger, society breaking up into warring factions. I'm sure you can see all that going around us even now, forever. Every such pressure group, if it's strong enough, self-righteously imposes its will on the rest, and everywhere the same thing is being done on an individual basis. The sum of all this mighty effort is less peace and less brotherhood than before. The philosophy of self-sufficiency is not paying off. When I ran the show, it didn't do me too much good. And then, you know, part of it for me, and many others, but I'll talk about me, because we're in AA and we talk about ourselves, not about everybody else. But the first natural thing was, God is so nebulous, and, you know, but there's my sponsor, or this person who I admire, okay, and who I may want to place all my faith and dependence. But what the book tells us, the 12 and 12, is that no adult man or woman, for example, should be in too much emotional dependence upon a parent. They should have been weaned long before, and if they have not been, they should wake up to the fact. So, too much dependence. You know, one of the things, one of the hallmarks I learned of alcoholism, I read this somewhere, or someone told me this, or both, is our overwhelming, amazing immaturity. You know, we're self-centered, we're babies, we want what we want when we want it, and we don't want to have to do our work to get it either. It just should be there because we are the wonderful I. And then when that doesn't happen, we drink. And that's certainly how it was for me. In the beginning, you know, we started by relying on AA. But surely, you know, it starts to become clear. I want to skip ahead to something that's most important, because a lot of times when we talk about step three, we talk about willpower and our will and God's will and how do I know what God's will is and on and on and on and on. But, you know, reliance on God's will for me, I couldn't stand back and not take care of my own life. And in fact, that's not a good way to live life. But it's about right use of will. And to go back to my notes. So it appears there are certain things which only the individual can do. And I'm reading from page 40 of the 12 and 12. It appears there are certain things which only the individual can do. All by himself and in the light of his own circumstances, he needs to develop the quality of willingness. And so that's my task. When he acquires willingness, he is the only one who can make the decision to exert himself. So I can't make you do anything. Your sponsor can't. Your mama can't. You have to decide that for yourself. I had to decide that for myself, that I was going to go forward and carry on and make the effort. trying to do this is an act of his own will. So acting on our will, I guess, isn't necessarily always bad, you know? All of the 12 steps require sustained and personal exertion to conform to their principles, and so we trust to God's will. It is when we try to make our will conform with God's will that we begin to use it rightly. To all of us, that was a most wonderful revelation. Our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps, and step 3 begins to open this door. That was a huge revelation to me, you know, and I would talk to my sponsor about how do I know what God's will is and blah blah, where does my will and his will and on and on. And the best answer I got was to do what's in front of me to do, and whatever works out was God's will. So that was the best answer I'd ever gotten, and all these years later it still works for me to do what's in front of me to do. Do everything I can think of to address the problem, and then sit back and let the result go. You know, let the result happen. But I wanted to go to as Bill sees it. And as Bill sees it, it's two quick things. 172. Oh, crap. But of why it actually makes sense to rely on God. First of all, in a letter from 1966, Bill Wilson writes this: "Nothing can be more demoralizing than a clinging and abject dependence upon another human being." Isn't that an ugly picture? "This often amounts to the demand for a degree of protection and love that no one could possibly satisfy. So our hoped-for protectors finally flee, and once more we are left alone, either to grow up or to disintegrate." So that's among the reasons why it makes sense to depend upon a God, a higher power, a God of our understanding. And then the 12 and 12 goes on to say, "We discovered the best possible source of emotional stability to be God himself. We found that dependence upon his perfect justice, forgiveness, and love was healthy, and that it would work where nothing else would. If we really depended upon God, we couldn't very well play God with our fellows, nor would we feel the urge to rely wholly on human protection and care." So those are among the reasons of why it makes sense to rely on God. And then this is my favorite. Okay, this is a brief snippet from the big book, AA, page 133. This is maybe the best reason I've come to believe to turn my will and life over. "We are sure God would like to see us happy, joyous, and free. Hence, we cannot subscribe to the belief that this life necessarily has to be a vale of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it became clear that most of the times we had made our own misery." And so that's what Bill has to say about the good sense of turning it over. So, you know, the willpower, the willingness, making a decision. One of, you know, something we just read, and something that for me, I'm guilty as anyone, in the beginning of a meeting, we always read how it works. And a lot of times it becomes the blah, blah, buzz noise while we're getting our coffee and getting settled and waving to our friend or whatever. But, you know, there's a lot of content in how it works. In fact, they do describe how it works. And it's found at page 58 to 60 at the big book. But it lays out the problem perfectly. The first step of admission, of acceptance, of seeking for a better way to be. What How It Works says is we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness of our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. I mean, that's surrender. That's surrender. That's a first step. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. That's like a second step right there. Okay? May you find a God. Come to believe. Come to believe. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. The thing is, this little passage, it thoroughly describes our dilemma. It describes our program. It describes how our program can work with for anyone who has the ability and the willingness to be honest with themselves. That includes people with mental disorders, emotional disorders, all kind of problems. If they have the capacity to be honest, I mean, it's a very, to me, I look at this and this is a hugely open, inclusive, welcoming passage. You know, it's saying you can do this. You can, if you can manage this little bit of mental attitude and start moving one foot in front of the other. And that's what a third step is about, how the program can work for anyone. And it does, you know, talk about the centrality of God to recovery. It talks about the point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. And then the ABCs that says it all. You know, it is the ABCs of alcoholism. A, that we were alcoholic, we could not manage our own life, step one. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Step two, that God could and would if he were sought. And the book says, being convinced, we were at step three. It's all, it just, you know, if to me, to read through it again, and with this context and mindset, was really illuminating. So then we run into our self-will. You know, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. It says that in the big book. I believe that. I'm a living example of that because I want it, you know, my way all the time anyway. The self-centeredness, the ego, the conning, the immaturity, the endless demands of the alcoholic, they're all covered in these pages. And it talks about, the big book expresses it as such, admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? See, I would cry reading this because I really believed if I managed good enough, I'd be okay, and it never worked. Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And I suffer that. I identify with that. That's me, because even when I tried to do better, I seem to not be able to do better. The big book I want to mention, too, repeatedly uses the word delusion. I don't think the word denial is in there. It's always delusion. So I just want to mention that they say denial is a rehab word, and delusion is a big book word. So anyway, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our problems, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find out that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Guilty, guilty as charged me on all of those counts. It's true, because it was all about me. And then when you hurt me or responded to my bad attitude or bad actions, then I was shocked and upset. I was an alcoholic, which means I was self-centered, immature, self-seeking, egotistical, big baby, His Majesty the baby, someone used to say years ago in the rooms, probably still do. So it goes on to talk about the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes this possible. We had to quit playing God. It didn't work. We decided that hereafter, God was going to be the director. He was the principal. We were the agent. He's the father. We are his children. And it goes on. We felt a new power flow in. I want to talk about taking the step, you know. Ooh, it's 7:03. I want to talk about the literal taking of the step three, because this is the first part, the first place where an actual action comes into play. Everything else has been thinking, talking, emoting, ruminating, some of my favorite things, cogitating, you know, you name it. But here's the first action. And I want to tell you how the book does talk about taking an action, that we were at step three. And it gives a prayer. And it also notes this: we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. I took my third step with my sponsor. I was taught that it was a decision to go forward with the rest of the program. And so what we did was I went to her house. We went to her home office, her study, and we got down on our knees and we held hands and we prayed out loud. And we said the third step prayer. I don't know who's familiar with it or who's not, but I'm going to read it to you anyway. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Now, when my sponsor and I did that, that was an immediate great experience. It was a feeling of peace and happiness, you know, contentment is maybe more like it, because it wasn't like elated happy. It was more of a peaceful happy. This is all right. This is going to be all right. You know, I can be better. I can be better. I'm going to do this, and I can be better. And I have had the experience. Anyone I've sponsored, I do this. That's what I do. People I spot, we take third steps. We go to a church, we go to a home, we go somewhere. We get on our knees, we hold hands, and we pray this prayer. Every time I have done this with anyone, it's been a wonderful experience. It renews me spiritually, personally. I only hope it's as helpful to the person I sponsor as it is to me, but I've never failed to get a benefit from taking that action. The last time I did it, I want to tell this story because it was kind of weird. I was at a work conference in Houston, And it was, I think, the National Association of Drug Court Professionals or something. It was a lot of professional people, and among these people, this whole huge convention in this gigantic convention center in downtown Houston, just a couple of blocks from Minute Maid Park. You know, they had an AA meeting at the beginning of each session day that was at 6 a.m. that was attended by maybe 10 to 12 people, and there were thousands of people at this convention and national. It was like, and people were going out to the bar and getting, you know, the whole thing. And I'm thinking, this is the drug court professionals. So just telling you, you know, I mean, out of this whole bunch, there's a handful of people. But I took it there that one of the people, I don't like to tell other people's stories, so I'll leave most of what his part was, but he was a couple of years sober and in a period of transition, and for a couple days in a row he's kind of like beating my ear, and I'm kind of a cranky person, yet somehow I project this maternal image. I don't know why. Somehow, though, some lost souls seem to look to me, and I'm not quite sure why, but they do, and I'm glad to be there. But we took a third step. We took a third step in Houston at this national NADCP conference. And again, we got down on our knees in this room we were meeting. The meeting was over. We held hands. We said the third step prayer. He pulled up the prayer on the cell phone, because you can get big book on, you know, on cell phone real easily. And we did it. And again, it was wonderful. It's never failed to lift my heart and renew my energy to literally take that step. Finally, because my sponsor was what they used to call, she was an old school big book thumper, and she said next, you know, and the book says next, okay? She said, enjoy this happy feeling, because you're going to start writing your fourth, like, not tomorrow, but the next day you're going to get busy on it. And I'll give you like this 36-hour little pink cloud period. And in fact, the book says right after that, you know, it describes, you know, doing the step and meeting God alone rather than with one who might misunderstand. But it said, this was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. And that's what I'm telling you. I felt that. I said before in, you know, the two previous weeks, I believe the steps are a felt experience. We can run through this as an intellectual exercise or a series of homework assignments or book reports, or we can dig deep, dig in, and feel the effect, feel the benefit, and then really get somewhere, really get the full feeling, because I think that's the intention of it. But it says next. And what I was taught was that the best evidence of having done a good third step was to do a fourth step, because in fact, a third step is a commitment and a promise to go on and to carry on. So I don't know how people like walk around with their fourth step bullshit inside them, you know, after they've done a third step. I don't know, because to me, I needed to get busy and get on it. But that's next week's topic. I did want to, well, I guess it's 7:10, so we can pull the plug now. I guess it's question time, so thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Is that better?
There we go.
Does anybody have any questions for Leslie?
I am pretty thorough, aren't I? It might be the legal training, but...
Kevin will get us started.
Oh, we've got someone in the back, too.
Oh, dude.
No, before we get to Kevin, because he's last always, right?
Thanks, Leslie. Jeff Alcoholic.
Hi, Jeff.
You touched on it. I know we say after we do our third step, we must act on our go to our fourth step.
It says next.
Next. What do you do when if you're working with a sponsee and they start to procrastinate on that fourth step? Do you think that they truly didn't make that decision and do a good third step? Do you make them go back and review the third step or go over the third step with them until he actually makes that decision and move forward and do the fourth?
There's only two ways. It's either they didn't make a proper third step or they got on with the fourth step. That's my thinking. So I don't know where how a third step is properly, thoroughly done without immediately moving on. So, like I said, it's very easy to just go through the motions and mouth the words or sit home and say, I've said that prayer, I've read it on a card or something. That's not a third step. A third step is taking the action. It's almost, the analogy, I hate to say it, but, one of the analogies that came to my mind when I was driving over here, so my late thoughts may not be my best. But when you commit, to a person, when you marry them, you make a promise to follow up and take action. And I know we're not marrying the program, but we are making a commitment, if no one else, to ourselves and to God, that we're going to go forward. So, some people, I don't believe in chasing pigeons. I just don't. If you want what we have, you'll do what you do, what we do. If you want my help, I'll be more than happy to give you my help and share my experience with you. But I don't see it as my place to arm twist or persuade somebody. I just don't. So I hope that's helpful.
Anyone else?
Oh no.
Thanks, Leslie. I can't let everybody get out this early. Anyway, when you were doing your third step, was it? And it was a while ago. So
it was.
It was.
It was. It was in 1981.
Right. So what were you doing in 1981?
What were you doing
in
1981?
I was doing in 1981.
I know. You told me about
anywhere.
That. You told me about that
way.
Check. Yeah. Right.
It was. That's right.
That check for rehab.
Lily blue. So one of the things that when you were, was there a time frame that your sponsor had you on? In other words, you said, I guess I'm an alcoholic. When you did your first step and you did your second step and you did your third step and you did your fourth step, was your sponsor keeping you on a time frame?
She really didn't, but she kept me reading, continuing to read in the big book and in the 12 and 12 was important, and to attend, to go to step study meetings and big book meetings. So she kind of kept me focused. She didn't put me, I wasn't put on a timetable, but I was kind of kept with a directed attention, let's say. When I was ready, but then when you're ready, you go.
Yeah.
And she was really, this was 1980. See, things were different then culturally. It was, if you want what we have, we'll do it, you'll do what we do. And if you don't want to do this, then there's five other drunks out there that I can help them. It was just that simple. Again, I don't know. I guess we've had a cultural transition of some sort, and leave others to decide what is the way to be. But I was not put on a time schedule. In fact, if anything, she slowed me down because she said, I know you're smart. I know you can read this book, and I know you can go through this like a book report. I want you to get this in your guts, in your heart, and have this be for real. So part of her part of her first step program for me was she'd drag me around to like homeless shelter meetings and remind me that I was a drunk like those guys, and to keep that real front and center in my mind. So that's kind of how I was sponsored. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's kind of the way I was. It was pretty much, it wasn't what I read or what I knew about the step. It was more what my experience was with the step. So when you take somebody through, do you kind of guide them the same way?
That's the goal. That's what I do. Some take to it better than others, but it is what it is, you know?
Okay.
Hi, Leslie. Barb, alcoholic.
Hi, Barb.
My question is, when I was in Glen Bay, I noticed there was a lot of people who expressed problems with having a higher power, having a belief in a hereafter, a belief in... And so when you approach people to help, how do you do... If the third step prayer is not going to work for them, I mean, how would you work with someone who absolutely does not believe that there is a higher power? Is that a stumbling block? How would you work that?
Well, I've never worked with anyone who flat out refused to believe in any kind of God or higher power. That's kind of outside my range of experience, number one. Number two, it's very clear that the AA program is built on belief in a higher power, and that the purpose of the big book is to help people discover a higher power within themselves that they can connect with. Now, that's a pretty broad avenue. So that's kind of, I mean, all I have is what was given to me through sponsorship and through the book, and that's what I have. So I don't feel it's my place to arm twist or persuade somebody. If what they want to do is get sober through working the 12 steps, I can help them. But, it's going to sound cold and cruel, but the fact is, you know, this program is for people who want it. It's not necessarily for people who need it. And there's a lot of people out there who need it, who aren't willing to do it. And in fact, that's what it says in How It Works. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That kind of says that you got to follow the path and find a way. Option B is to die a drunk. Option A is to find a higher power and live with dignity, self-respect, and some personal happiness. Those are the choices that there are. So perhaps laying out the choice, I mean, I've done that often. Here's your choice, you know, you know what happens with your way. You're drunk, your life's a mess. You know, you do things you're embarrassed to admit in the light of day, or you can go along with a belief in something beyond yourself, you know. And it really, the baseline is so basic, it's just, you know, all you really need in my mind to have a God is to not think that you're God. That's a pretty low bar, you know. And if we're not willing, if someone's not willing to do that, then we have to accept the gift. And not everyone wants to accept the gift. And we walk over dead bodies every day. And to me, it's important to understand that. It's a fatal disease. It will kill us. This is a way to dodge that awful fate. Well, then I tell them, then you have to make a choice, because that's the only way I know to get sober. It doesn't mean avoiding, it means being straightforward. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to have a faith in a higher power and a God of my understanding. That's what has kept me going all this time and has let me live my life in a way that I can be happy, joyous, and free. So it's really a question of not persuading. It's just laying out the facts and making a choice. And, you know, God willing, they'll see it. And if not, then you really, I wouldn't belabor the point. I'd point it out and let it go. You know, but whenever she wants it, then she may reach out. And it might not be to you. You know, who knows how God has a lot of has a lot of ways of working, but that's what letting go is kind of about. You know, in all kind of ways. You do?
All right.
Okay, good. Because I do have one last quick little thing to read for you, and it's.
Okay, so when you said in all three steps that you, when you came into this program and as you started your program, you were kind of, you believed in God, but you
hated him. I hated him. I was mad. I hated him.
Yeah,
I was so unhappy, and he just gave me a shitty hand to play.
So,
that was what I thought. So.
Right. So in the third step, you know, you kind of have to, you know, you've admitted that you're powerless. You turn your life over to the care of this person you hate or are in battle with all the time. When did that kind of switch for you?
Well, it started to switch when I went to, you know, last week I talked about my visit to the monastery. And that was a second step experience where I felt that, you know, I just had this conviction. I felt like my trouble was going out of the top of my head like a chimney. I believe that that was a God experience of just not the blinding light, just a warm conviction that this can be okay. This can be okay. It was as simple as that, and that was at St. Paul's Monastery in Pittsburgh. And so, see, it doesn't happen in a snap. It happened for me. That was an important aha moment, you know, that it would be okay. But, you know, I went to meetings 6 days a week because I was allowed to take off one day because of my crazy work schedule. But by attending meetings and talking to people and reading the book and watching and learning, I mean, I start to develop some like evidence of my own observation of what are people who are getting well doing? How are they living? Does any of them have something that I might want? You know, and if that is, then what are they doing to get it? You know, because I knew how I was. My life sucked. I came crawling to AA. So, you know, so it wasn't just I was mad at God and then whoopsie, it changed. It kind of came over time. But, okay. Well, I want to share this. Now I have to re-enter my password. Okay. Anyway, this was shared at the lawyers' meeting, and I want to thank our friend Matt here for sharing this, because I've shared this with another person who is not a member of our fellowship, although I didn't share the context where I got it. That person is also just a pretty faithful, godly person, which is funny, who thought I would hang out with people who were godly and pious, but that's a whole other thing. But anyway, I thought this fit well with the third step, because then, you know, I've done a lot of head beating over, am I following his will and blah, 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 and, you know. Anyway, here you go. This is a passage from Thoughts in Solitude, Thomas Merton. You know this one? Okay. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Okay.
Thank you, Leslie.